Yeah, I just want to go back a little bit to some things in Parshas Pinchas that we did not cover. And some of them are very, very interesting. We know that in Parshas Pinchas there is a second counting of the Jewish people. Now, why is there a second counting? Because the first counting was 40 years earlier, and that was the Jews who were 20 years old when they left Mitzrayim, and most of that generation, except for Yeshua and Kalev and the women, had died out in the course of 40 years. So the second counting are those who are actually going to enter the land of Israel, meaning to say they are now at the age of 20. Of course, they're younger children who are not counted in that second census either. They're now going to enter Eretz Israel, and they're 20 or up, and they're to be the ones who Eretz Israel is divided according to. Now, the Gemara in Bava Basra has a very, very intricate discussion of how Eretz Yisrael was divided, and Rashi alludes to it because there seems to be a contradiction in how things work. One pasuk says that the larger the family, the more land they got, meaning each person got a portion, and therefore a large family got more land and a small family got less land, because that's a per capita division. You give the land based on the people. And yet another pasuk says that lots were to be assigned, or portions were to be assigned by drawing lots, meaning to say you divide Israel and you draw up a lot, you get this, you get this, you get this. So which was it? Was it based on family size, or was it based on lots? So that's not really just, yeah.
Would lots be more equitable, like it was evenly divided, like in a grid?
So that's the thing. So that's going to be the question. What does lots mean exactly? So the way Rashi understands it, Rashi says there's no contradiction here, because lots just means Eretz Yisrael was divided geographically into 12 sections, but the size, but the sections had no boundary. You said, okay, there's the northern part and the southern part and the eastern part and the western part, but how large that's going to be determines on who gets it. We then draw lots which tribe. So if Yehuda gets the south, we then have to make the south big enough so that each person gets the same. So you see, so the first thing we did was, Al Pi Hashem, we divided Eretz Yisrael into geographical areas, but we didn't give their boundaries. Then, based on the lots, the boundaries were this big or that big or smaller or bigger, depending on the size of the tribe. So that's the first point. But the second point is more complicated, and that is, which was the population base for how Eretz Yisrael was divided? Was it based on the Jews who left Mitzrayim, or was it based on the Jews who came to Eretz Yisrael? For example, let's imagine that a person came to Mitzrayim. A person was with one of the 70 of Yaakov, and that person might have 5 descendants who are alive 40 years later who will be entering Eretz Yisrael, and another person might have 100 descendants. Now, if I say the population division is based on those who came to Mitzrayim, that would mean those two people would be given an equal portion, and that portion will be divided 100 ways to the guy that has a lot of descendants, and would only be divided 5 ways for the one who had fewer descendants, which means to say each descendant of the 5, within the 5, would get much more land than the descendant. In other words, this is, if you want to be legal, I don't know if anyone's planning to go to law school, this is called per stirpes in law. That means you go by the roots, meaning to say the division was based on the original population base, and then it gets divided. Now, you may argue that seems a little unfair, because that means two people come to Eretz Yisrael, and one person only gets, you know, 1/10 of the land of somebody else, based on the fact that what was allocated to their ancestor had to be subdivided among many more people. But that is one opinion. That is the shita that says Eretz Yisrael was divided based on the Yotzei Mitzrayim. In other words, it was divided into 600,000 pieces, each of which was assigned to the Yotzei Mitzrayim to then be divided among their descendants. There is a second view, which perhaps makes the most sense in terms of Pashat Pshat, that it was divided based on the Bo'ei Ha'aretz themselves, meaning to say, we have 600,000 new souls that are coming to the land of Israel. Each one of them will get an equal portion of land, based on lottery. Now, there's the lottery. See, the lottery was done in multiple ways. The first lottery determined where a tribe lives. So we divided Eretz Yisrael into 12 districts. So the lot would, you know, Moshe would draw up, Yoshua did it. Yoshua would draw up one card that would say Yehuda, and the other card that would say Southern District. Right? So now we know that belongs to Yehuda. So then all the families of Yehuda, we would subdivide the land in various ways. So according to Bo Haaretz, two people who came to the land, and no matter what tribe, you got the same amount of land, because the per capita division was not based on how many of your ancestors came to Mitzrayim. It's simply based on how many of you are coming into Eretz Yisrael now. Okay, that is the shita that is called Bo'ei Haaretz. So there are two opinions in the Gemara. One says Eretz Yisrael was divided based on the Yotzei Mitzrayim, and another opinion says Eretz Yisrael was divided based on the Bo'ei Haaretz. To make things very complicated, Rashi follows neither view, and Rashi gives you an intermediate, again, it's from the Gemara itself. Rashi gives you an intermediate view that says the following. Rashi says the initial portions were divided based on Bo'ei Haaretz, but then the Yerusha goes backwards. Now let me explain what this means. Let's imagine you have two brothers, which was actually the case. Two brothers come to Mitzrayim, Reuven and Shimon. Right? They came to Mitzrayim. Right? Reuven and Shimon came to Mitzrayim. Reuven has 100. Actually, he had much more. The truth is, Reuven had 50,000. I mean, Reuven had thousands and thousands of people, and Shimon had less, right? Because if you recall, Shimon's tribe was the one that really lost a lot of people. Shimon lost more than 50% of its numbers, because Shimon was involved in Baal Peor. In other words, there are many of the Averos in the desert that were Shimon. So between Reuven and Shimon, let's say, I'm going to use approximation numbers, Reuven has around 50,000 people. Shimon has around 20,000 people. Okay, so let's assume between Reuven and Shimon, we have 70,000 portions of the land of Israel. Okay, so we look at all the tribes, and each tribe gets portions based on their land, based on their size rather. But we then move the inheritance backwards. The Gemara calls this the opposite of normal Yerusha. Normal inheritance means the past generations give it to the future generations. Here, the future generations bring it to the past, to the common ancestor of Reuven and Shimon, as if the property goes back to Yaakov. Now, let's imagine, if Yaakov Avinu, through a backwards inheritance, would inherit 70,000 portions of land, it would then, let's imagine he only had two sons, just to make it easy, it would then turn out that 35,000 would go to Reuven, 35,000 would go to Shimon, and then it gets divided that way. Meaning to say, you initially divided into 70,000 pieces, but instead of Reuven getting 50,000 and Shimon getting 20,000, it turns out Reuven's descendants will get 35,000 portions, and Shimon's descendants will be getting 35,000 portions. Now, according to that, it does turn out that smaller tribes actually got more property, because essentially the extra land that goes to the bigger tribe goes backwards to a common ancestor, Yaakov, and then goes down and is divided among the trees. The logic of it, again, I don't want to be marked too much because it's a very, very technical area, but this is called Hachzoras Nachala. Hachzoras Nachala means the moving of inheritance backwards. So initially, we divide the land according to the number of people coming, but we then deem the land to be owned by the common ancestor, which would take you back to Yaakov, and from Yaakov, therefore, it divides equally among all of the tribes. Again, I have to admit, it's difficult to understand how to fully reconcile that with the Torah's directive that the larger family gets more land, because apparently that's not going to be the case. The larger family initially gets more land, but then it's divided among everybody, and if it's divided among everybody, people in larger families are going to get less land than people in smaller families. Yeah.
So it was pretty much just the land of Israel was divided in 12 equal districts and then split up.
Well, no. We're not. Well, the question would be more or less. Yeah, more or less. That would actually create into equality. That's correct. That would result in the idea that every tribe had the same amount of territory. Now, yeah. Again, if you look at maps, you're going to see that that may or may not be true. But most maps do not draw the territories to be equal. But on the other hand, we're not sure about all of these cities. In Yoshua, it gives you the borders of these, and we're not really sure where it is. So it could be equal, could not be equal. We're not sure. But that would be the idea, that if all of the tribes had an equal size of territory, then obviously the individual in a large tribe got less than the individual in a small tribe. Yeah. Yeah.
How did we know where to draw the boundaries of the territories?
Yeah, we have to assume that Hashem said where the general territories were, but we're not really told explicitly. There are a lot of details that are not given yet. Okay.
That's the case then. Why have a lottery in the first place? Why not Hashem just tell us who's going to be in which?
Yeah, so part of this was, well, you're right. I mean, why have lotteries? Why go through all of this? Let's Hashem say, you get this, you get this. But part of it was HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to inspire confidence in what the Chachamim do, even if there's no explicit divine voice. It's kind of a trust in Torah Shebaal Peh. In fact, this idea of a lot, because based on this, there are many tshuvas that talk about lotteries as having a form of divine inspiration. For example, let's imagine that we have 11 people on a boat, and the boat can only hold 10 people, and the boat is going to sink. Now, if we know who the 11th guy is, we can throw him overboard because he's a rodent. He's endangering the boat. But if all 11 people got on the boat at the same time, you can't throw one guy over because maybe the other guy's the rodent, right? Who's the rodent? You can't define. But it is brought down that if everybody agrees, now everybody has to agree. If everybody agrees, we can do a lottery, and if his name comes up, you know, he can be thrown over because he agreed to the lottery. If you remember, that was exactly the story of Yonah. And the Mefarshim say, why is a lottery okay? Because we assume like a lottery is like a message from Hashem who should be the one. So there is something to what is called a goral. So again, I don't want to go into it in too much because it's a very, very technical area, but at least be aware that the way Eretz Yisrael was divided was not at all pashut. The portions were divided according to the people who come to Eretz Yisrael, but then it went back and went down through Yaakov, which would make it divided equally in those 12 ways. But then you have to subdivide it further among all of the different descendants. So even within families, there would be a lack of equality. You'd have to trace every child, every grandchild, and have it divided that way. Another thing is, of course, that the Parsha established the law of the daughters of Tzlafchad, that although normally if there are sons, daughters do not inherit, but when there are no sons, daughters do inherit. It's interesting to be aware of the fact that in the laws of Yerusha, sons have precedence over daughters, daughters have precedence over brothers or parents and the like. And then we have the special din that a bechor, a firstborn, inherits a double portion. So here, there's a very, very interesting halacha that a person might not be aware of. What if a person had a son and a daughter? Just to give you an idea of how things can be anomalous. A son and a daughter, and both the son and the daughter have their own kids. So the son has only a daughter, and the daughter has only a son. So both the son and the daughter died. So when the grandparents die, they have two grandchildren, a boy and a girl. But you know, the halacha is the girl is going to get everything and the boy is going to get nothing. Why? Because a grandchild is not a direct heir. A grandchild does not inherit property directly. A grandchild gets property through their dead parents. So consequently, if a person had a son and a daughter, all of the inheritance goes to his son. Now, if the son is dead, it will then go to his son's child. If his son's child is a daughter, the daughter will get it. As opposed to the daughter, who gets nothing, her son will not get anything. from the daughter, except for what the daughter owns herself. So it is interesting that this kind of almost, it's almost like a Trivial Pursuit question. When will a daughter, when will a girl get 100% of the property and the boy get nothing? That is when they are grandchildren and the boy is the son of a daughter and the girl is the daughter of a son. The daughter of a son will get everything and the son of a daughter will get nothing. Because the Yerusha of grandchildren is via the deceased children, based on their inheritance rights. Not only that, but the child of a Bechor will get Pishnayim. Let's make it even more. Let's assume that there are multiple sons, and the sons died, and one of them was a firstborn, and the firstborn has a daughter. Not only will she get her father's portion, but she will also get the double portion, because she does inherit, assuming there's no other brother she has, she does inherit the double portion. Now, again, I don't want to get too heavy in technical halacha, but this raises a very, very important practical question. And that is, normally for most of us, if we have sons and daughters, we want to be sure that our daughters will get something. Halachically, are you allowed to make a will? If you make a will, is it valid? Are you circumventing Yerusha? Or even if you just have boys. Let's say one boy is a Bechor who's supposed to get a double portion, but you would like everybody to have equally. Are you allowed to change that? So here is the basic concept. According to most poskim, a stam will is a violation of halacha for the following reason. It is fundamental that you cannot give away. I mean, when you're alive, you can give away your property if you want. If I want to give away my property when I'm alive to my daughter instead of my sons, I can do that because I could give my property away to charity or to anybody I want. But the problem is a will does not give away your property when you're alive. A will directs where your property should go after you die. Now, as soon as you die, your property is no longer yours. It belongs to your heirs. So if a person dies and has a son and a daughter, all the property belongs to his son. If the daughter will take under the will by going to a secular court, she will be guilty of stealing from the son. So even if she can go to court and the court will give her the property, it is a maisa gezeila unless the son agrees, which he could agree. He could agree. And in fact, in many, many families, if it's not such a machlokas, you just agree. But theoretically, if a son doesn't get everything under a will, the son will be able to take his sister to Beis Din and say, you are not allowed to hold on to any of this property. You have to give it to me. So as a result, here is what I'm saying. It's not forbidden to write a will. As a father, I can say, this is what I want. That's okay. I can tell my son, I want you to give some of your inheritance to your sister. So it's not an avera to write a will, but it would be an avera to enforce a will over the objections of the person that min haTorah has the right to get that property. Okay, that's important. It is actually forbidden for a girl to take an inheritance over the objection of her brother. It would be forbidden for a boy to take something that would deprive the Bechor of Pishnayim. The will is an expression of parental wishes, but even the mitzvah of Kibud Aviyim would not be binding for a very simple reason. The Gemara in Kedushin says, Kibud Aviyim requires me to honor my parents with their money, but not with my money, and once they die, it's my money. So I'm not mechuyev. Kibud Aviyim does not obligate me to listen to a will. So, what is the solution? What is the solution? Okay, I just want to get, what is the solution for this? So, if you have a family where people don't fight, maybe you don't have to do a solution. Meaning, I write a will saying, these are my wishes, and I trust my children will carry out my wishes. If everybody carries out the will, I want to emphasize, it's not a problem. It is mutter for me to say, I want my daughter to get equal, and it's mutter for the brother who would inherit to say, I'll give my sister a half of the estate, okay? But we don't always tell people rely on the goodwill of your children. Unfortunately, it happens to be, and I've seen it myself, that it's very unfortunate, but when it comes to money, especially when the parents die, sometimes relationships break down. So the question is there any halachic way that I can, if I'm a morish, that I can guarantee that my daughter gets a chelek? So it's interesting, going back to the time of the very early Achrayim, this is around the time of the Taz and even before the Taz, the Gedolim in Europe developed a halachic document, which is also legally enforceable, that can do this. And they do this by what's called a shtar chov. And this is what the way it works. A person writes a will which simply says his wishes. My wishes are that my estate should be divided equally, let's say, between my son and my daughter. Or even more importantly, my wife. Because remember, a wife does not inherit. When a man dies, a woman collects her kesuva. But kesuva is not necessarily that much. The amount of a kesuva might only be the equivalent of $20,000 if you measure silver value. So contrary to secular law, where a woman will inherit generally from her husband, according to halacha, it goes to the children. Even a daughter will inherit ahead of a wife. A husband inherits a wife does not inherit a husband. So here's my issue. I want to be sure that my wife will get everything, or I want to be sure that my sons and my daughters will be equal, or I want to be sure that all of my sons get equal and the Bechor will not get Pishnayim, right? And I don't trust everybody being nice, so I want to be sure halachically there's no way that my son could go to Beis Din and demand that the property be given back. So the way a shtar chov works is the following. We know under general principles of Dinei Mamonos, a person can create a chiyuv to somebody, meaning to say, I can create a chiyuv. I could write a shtar, or have a shtar signed by witnesses, that says, I will pay you $10,000. That's a shtar chov. So, what the person does is the following. In addition to the will, which is a separate legal document, he writes a shtar chov for a very large amount that says, one moment before my death, I hereby obligate myself to pay $1,000,000 to my wife, and this debt is a shibud, it is a lien on all of my property, and my wife will have the right to collect from 1 minute before my death, you know, until she gets paid $1,000,000. And you pick a very high amount, pick $10,000,000. You then say, but if, you make a condition, but this debt is conditional on my heirs not carrying out the terms of my last will and testament, but if they carry out the terms of my will, this obligation shall become null and void. So, and this is signed by witnesses, and it becomes a regular shtar. Now, the way this works is the following. That means when the man dies, the yorshim have a choice. The son can say, I'm taking everything, that's my right under the Torah, and nobody can stop me, and that's true. You have the 100% right to take everything. But if you take everything, there is an outstanding shtar chov on you in which you now owe your mother or your sister $10 million, which she can enforce by taking the property, and that'll leave you with nothing at all. So you're put to the choice. Keep my status as yoresh, but have to pay $10 million, or voluntarily give up half of the property in order to get out of the indebtedness, right? This is called a shtar chatzi zachor, and this is, by the poskim say, this is a good etzah to guarantee that a daughter will get inheritance rights or a wife will get inheritance rights and the like. You simply have to create a shtar chov that takes effect while you're alive, because you can't do it after you're dead. The shtar chov creates a shibud on all of the property, and the shtar chov is much, much larger than whatever you would have to give up under the will, and you're given the choice to follow the will and thereby terminate the shtar chov, or assert my rights under Yerusha and then have to pay the shtar chov. And normally the advantage would be you would much rather comply with the will and terminate the shtar chov, right? And there's a way, you know, again, it's not such a it may sound more complicated than it is. There's actually a form that you can write. You don't have to show your lawyer. Your lawyer, you can show the will. But you have to explain to your children that I am making the shtar chov here, that if you decide to go to Beis Din and become a yoresh, that's fine, but then you will be chayev this shtar chov, this shibud that I created, one second before my death. Yeah.
Why not make the Strakhov payable to each of the children? So divide up the Strakhov and say four kids, divide them up into.
Well, the question would become. Okay. You don't need four Strakhov. Meaning to say, we just want to basically say, the Strakhov to one will terminate if you comply with the will. Mm-hmm. Now, you could do multiple Strakhov. Yeah, I mean, you could do that too. You could say to each one. Or you can do, I'm just giving an example where there's one person that you want to be sure gets protected. One daughter, one wife. You know, if you have multiple people, you can do multiple Shtarichov. The only requirement is that the Shtarichov take effect before death, 1 second before death, and that it be an amount that's much, much larger than what you're being asked to give up under the will. Because otherwise you'll say, I'll pay the smaller amount to keep my rights. Yeah.
To ensure your wife gets inheritance, can you just make your kasuba larger?
Yes, absolutely. You could do that. Yeah, yeah. But most of us don't do that because the standard Ashkenazic kasuba. Yeah, the standard Ashkenazic kasuba is fixed, right? In other words, it's a pre-printed form. Theoretically, a kasuba can be enlarged and the like, and that can be done. And many Sephardic kasubas are tailor-made negotiated kasuvas that actually specify a million shkolim or whatever it is. The minhag of Ashkenazim, for whatever reason, I don't even know what the reason is, has been that we just leave it standard. So as a result, this is what you do. But you certainly can make the ksuba larger. Now let me just make one other point there. It is important to understand that even without a will and even without a shtarchov, widows and young girls have a lot more protection than you would think. I mean, let's take a simple case where there's no will and there's no shtarchov, and a man dies and has sons, a widow, and daughters. So you might think by reading the Torah that the sons get everything, the widow gets nothing, and the daughters get nothing. That would be your impression. But that's not entirely true. First of all, as you already said, the woman does get a ksuva, which may not be much, but no, that's $20,000, but there's something more important than the ksuva. If she is a widow, before she gets her ksuva, she is entitled to live in the family home rent-free, so the sons cannot kick her out and they have to pay the mortgage and the rent. And from the estate, she is entitled, from the assets that her husband left, she is entitled to get mizonos. Now, mizonos means food, clothing, and basic expenses, to the same degree she was getting from her husband. So if her husband was treating her fancy, she lives a fancy lifestyle. Now, obviously, she's not in control of the money. The kids are in control of the money, but in a sense, she could go to Basin, and Basin would order the children to give her the house and give her this, give her a living allowance. And that will last until she gets married, remarried, or until she collects her ksuba. So you understand, because of this, it makes no sense for a woman to collect her ksuba until she's ready to get married. Because if she were to collect her ksuba when she's not ready to get married, she could be kicked out of the family house and she would no longer get her mizonos allowance. But this way, she is not collecting her ksuba right now. She is living in the house rent-free. She doesn't have to pay for the mortgage or the utilities. And she gets an allowance. Right now, that doesn't work if she's divorced. If she's divorced, she only gets kasuva. But a widow gets mizonos and dira. So that's very important to know, that she's not simply out on the street. And in fact, if that means she's using up the whole estate, then so be it, even if there'll be nothing left for the kids. Because she's decided to be a widow, you know, for the rest of her life, you know, she does it. Now, eventually, when she dies, the house doesn't go to her or her daughter, her children, it'll go to them if she has other children and the like, but at least for her lifetime she has the right to live in that house. That's one thing to keep in mind. So we have to know that even if a daughter doesn't inherit, I'm sorry, even if a widow doesn't inherit, she has those rights. Now, there is a similar rule for daughters, a little different. Daughters are also entitled to be supported from their brother's estate until they get married. And when they get married, they then get 10% of the estate as a dowry. And the Gemara asks the Kashas, what if there are 10 girls and each one gets 10% of the estate? So the Gemara has a it's a very complicated. The formula basically is, if anyone here is an accountant, you'll appreciate it. It's 10% based on a declining balance, which is then redistributed. Again, let me give you an example. Let's assume, say, very similar to what we just
quick.
Yeah, let's assume we have two boys, and let's say one boy, and 10 girls. Okay, the estate is $1 million. And let's assume that mother remarried, so there's no issue of the widow getting anything. Okay, so you have one boy, 10 girls, $1 million. So the one boy is the owner of $1 million of property. That's fine. But as each girl gets married, the first girl gets a $100,000 dowry. That's fine. Now, when the next girl gets engaged, she does not get $100,000 dowry because the estate is no longer $1 million, it's only $900,000. So she'll get $90,000. And the third girl will get 10% of what's left. But at the end of the day, after all the girls are married, we take the total amount that was given back, given out, and we redistribute it, divided by 10. So if you add up 100, 90, 80, 70, then add it up, divided by 10, so then every girl winds up getting equal. In other words, the earlier girls who got married have to kick back some money to the girls who got married later. But that means, because it's a declining balance, you never get the estate down to zero. Because you're not taking 10%, 10%, 10%, 10%. It's 10% of what's left. So there'll always be something for the estate. Again, the point of this is not so much to give you all the halachas, but just to understand that the notion that a woman does not inherit isn't as bad as you might think. There are these protections that the chachamim get. Yeah.
The issue of the widow being able to live in the home and get expenses.
I'm sorry.
Wouldn't that be almost considered like ribis? Like, because you're owed the kasuba. You're not collecting. You can hold on to that money. The benefit
Yeah.
of you holding on to that money is me getting essentially money.
Yeah, that's very, very interesting. And in fact, I don't know if you're thinking of this analogy, but your question is very analogous to a law of ribis, and that is that if I lend you money and you offer me, let's say, the use of a vacation home rent-free until the loan is paid back.
Yeah.
In other words, let's say I borrow money or I lend you money, and you say, hey, I got this nice home in Sfat that, you know, is not being used, and you're welcome to be there for a few weeks to give me some more time to pay back the loan. The Gemara calls that ribis because the malva is getting the benefit of occupancy in addition to the loan. So your question would be, it's very interesting, your question would be that for the widow to get all of these payments until she gets her kesuva would be analogous to getting interest for deferring the payment of the kesuva. It is a good question, but I would say that the difference is, the reason it's not interest, it would be interest if the borrowers, if the boys, the sons, would be using this as a way of deferring payment. Here it's the other way around. They would rather pay her right away. Mm-hmm. And she is saying, I don't want to get paid.
She can turn down the payment.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. That's exactly the point. That's what I'm saying. A widow will not want to get her ksuba. She'll basically say, I don't want to be paid by you. I'd rather have the house and get my mazonos till I'm ready to get married. So since she is the one that is dictating this rather than they as an accommodation to them, so it wouldn't be ribis. But you are correct. Okay? So this is a little bit of technical halacha. I apologize if it was too technical that you need to know. But again, this will help you. There the perek, the eighth and ninth prakim of Bava Basra actually talk about this. You go to the Mishnayos, you'll see the 10% dowry, Isser Nechasim. In Ksuvas, we have many prakim about an almana getting mizonos. So it's always important when you hear a statement, because people are going to tell you, and again, I don't have a perfect answer. He says, hey, the Torah is not fair. The daughters of Tzlafchad got partial equality, but not really. Their equality was, if there's no sons, we get. But that's not real equality, because if there are sons and daughters, the daughters don't get. So people are going to ask you, you know, hey, the Torah is not fair, the Torah discriminates, or the Torah does not protect women's rights. These are going to be the questions that people always ask. So I'm not giving you an answer, really. I can't say I have a full answer. But at least when you take the full perspective of it, you see it's not such a bad, horrendous situation as you would imagine. First of all, we have the will option with the shtar chov, which can create equality. Second of all, even without the shtar chov, for the widow, we have mazonos and the house, as well as the ksuva. And for the daughters, we also have mizonos and the 10% dowry when they get married. So as a result, the Torah is not leaving people out in the cold. And in point of fact, in many cases, the widow's claim and the daughter's claim may actually use up the whole estate. In other words, it may actually leave the boys with nothing. The Mishnah says beferish, if by paying off the widow and the daughters, that leaves the boys as beggars, so be it, that the priority actually goes to the widow's claims and the daughter's claims. So it's important in any question, when people ask questions on the Torah, the first step you have to have, even if you don't have a philosophical answer, is be sure you have your facts straight. Because sometimes if you know the actual facts, you see that the situation is not as difficult. I'll give you another quickie example. Take Amalek. Again, the issue of Amalek is a very, very difficult issue. You know, on one hand, we look at Islamic fundamentalism, which talks about jihad and, you know, killing people and infidels, and we say that's awful and that's evil. So someone says, well, yeah, but you have in your own Torah the mitzvah of eradicating Amalek and having no mercy, and it says specifically every man, every woman, every child, even the animals, but even man, woman, child. So you have jihad too. Well, you know, why are you better, right? Why are you better than this? But the truth of the matter is, if you learn the Rambam, you see that, yeah, there is a mitzvah to kill Amalek. But number one, we don't know who they are. So in other words, it's kind of, you know, we never apply this. But more importantly, you see, according to the Rambam, an amazing thing, that according to the Rambam, even Amalek, you offer them peace before you kill them. And offering them peace means, if they are willing to accept the Jewish rule over Eretz Israel, and they are willing to obey, not become Jewish, they're willing to obey the 7 commandments of Noah, you do not kill Amalek under those circumstances. So you only kill an Amaleki who refuses to accept the 7 commandments of Noah, like a terrorist who has refused to renounce murder. Now, to be honest, I have to tell you that Rashi's Shita is not that way. Rashi's Shita is, when it comes to Amalek, we don't make any deals with Amalek. And according to Rashi, there would be this problem of killing. But even then, we would just say that, hey, if you know that Amalek is going to grow up to become a mass murderer, you know, God tells you, God is telling you, so, you know, you do what you got to do. But at least according to the Rambam, you know, Amalek is not really a true genocide, because an Amalekite could accept. Did you want to?
Yeah. Don't you do that with idolaters? Don't you offer any goy the 7 Noah had law than Eretz?
Well, that is a good question. In other words, the question according to the Rambam, which is a very good question, is, if the Amalekite is killed only because he doesn't accept the Noahide laws, then every Gentile is supposed to be killed if they don't keep the Noahide laws. What is unique about Amalek? Right? If a non-Jew violates the Noahide laws, according to the strict halacha, the non-Jew can be put to death. It is a good question. According to the Rambam, it's not clear what is unique now about Amalek if it's just a question of not accepting the Noahide laws. Did you want to say? Yeah.
Yeah, I have a question. So let's say the son, he doesn't want to give the money to his 10 sisters,
yes,
stepmother, whatever the
yep
situation may be.
Yep.
So he gets his $1 million right when the
yep
the father dies, but
right
he still has an obligation to,
yes,
to dish out all this money. Sorry,
yep,
you already explained.
Yep.
But he really doesn't want to give the money out. He wants to find a way around it. Can he go invest in real estate? Can he go, like, take out some stocks? Do whatever he can to, like, spend the money.
Well, listen. Like anything else, if he spends
or
the money,
or go to Vegas.
Okay. So this depends. If he spends the money and goes to Vegas, then like anything else, the women are going to be in trouble, just like any creditor that's owed money.
Okay.
If you, on the other hand, if he puts it into something, real estate or whatever it is, they can go to Basedin and have that stock and that real estate liquidated to pay their shares. In other words, they have the status of creditors. Now, like any creditor, you can always cheat your creditor by doing all sorts of stuff, and halacha can't stop you necessarily, because once, if you don't have the money, what are you going to do? Or what are we going to do? You know, but that's cheating, and that's forbidden, and that's a sin. On the other hand, any property you do have can be liquidated and given to them, because they actually have claims that a Basedin will enforce.
Yeah. So the almoner has rights to the dira, but the son theoretically owns the dira.
That's correct.
So if he was to sell it, then she would get the money of the dira?
Yes. So well, she doesn't get the money. The way it works is, and this would have to go to a Basedin. He does have the right to sell it, but he must give her an equivalent quality residence, which he still owns. But you know, the new house must go to her for her occupancy. And obviously, in a Basedin, it's a very controversial issue. What's equivalent? What if it's a different neighborhood? Same, you know, nice type of apartment or house, but a different neighborhood. How much is familiarity important? Certainly, for an older person, being in familiar surroundings is an extremely important thing. So those are going to be difficult shilas. But the standard is it has to be a comparable place to live. Yeah.
Are there any averot which disqualify someone from receiving rusha?
No. This is an interesting point. There are no rules about a rusha. Now Chazal do indicate that there may be a mitzvah for you to give away your property so that the Ben Rusha does not inherit. But the laws of Yerusha are not affected per se, meaning whatever the person had when he dies, even a Ben Rusha gets. And even Lachari, even if he converted to another religion, which we don't recognize, even if he intermarried, the only thing is, let me just remind you, because of the rules of matrilineal descent, if my Jewish son married a non-Jewish woman and had kids, those kids are not treated as either my child or the grandchildren of the deceased, so they would have no rights of inheritance automatically, simply because they're not Jewish, and therefore they're not related. But on the other hand, if my Jewish daughter married a Jewish man and had kids, and my daughter has the right to inherit, that will pass to her a Jewish child, although he is the product of a forbidden intermarriage. So it's not the sin that affects any of this. But what affects it is the lineage. If the descendant is not Jewish, they would not have inheritance rights. Yeah.
The son that owns the property where the widow can live,
yeah.
he could live there too if he wishes also, yeah?
He can, but only if, again, it would have to be a situation where she is as comfortable. Again, these are difficult questions.
If there was a guest room, he could live
there. Right, if it's a big enough house that he's not infringing on her privacy, he could live there as well, yeah.
Do we still give dowries today?
Well, yeah, we do, absolutely. I mean, if you think about it, maybe we don't call it a dowry, but think about, in fact, it's a big problem. In Eretz Yisrael in particular, it's a big problem. Now, often the dowry could be on either side, but it might be if you have some real good guy in Panovich or Mir, you know, and he may have a price. He basically may say, not this is as good, he may say that he will marry somebody only if the in-laws put up money for an apartment in Jerusalem. And the like. That is a dowry, right? So essentially that is the case. So dowries are still around, particularly for top rate kolo people, although okay, I don't want to get into that. I mean one might say that anybody that's demanding a certain price maybe by definition is not truly top rate, because a top rate person does not care so much about money, but that is part of the problem in the system. Yeah.
So if you're not the first one, like in my case, so I have to like tell my brother, I have to like tell him about the halachas. So
that's correct. That's correct. That's correct. That's correct. I know that. Yeah, I know that older brothers love two things. They love the double portion, and they love the drasha of Chazal that with kabedus avicha, you have to honor your father and mother, and the word s includes older brother. You must honor your older brother. so they love that. That's a machlokas. Does that mean only the oldest brother, or every older brother can look down at the one below him and say, you got to respect me? That's a machlokas. But the double portion is only the oldest of the old, oldest of the old. By the way, the minhag is, with all of these documents and the wills and everything else, that you do have a chelek of the estate that should follow the order of Yerusha of the Torah. In other words, there should be something that the Bechor gets a double portion. So the minhag is Sifrei Kodesh. The minhag is that Sforim should be divided according to the law of Bechor. Everything else you can do a will and other things, but you should leave a portion of the estate to follow the inheritance of the Torah. Yeah.
If you had a situation whereby you had a non-Jewish man married to a Jewish woman, so yep. The kids would be Jewish.
Yep.
How does the Yerusha from the non-Jewish father work?
Okay, so basically you ignore her husband totally, and we simply ask ourselves, the non-Jewish father.
Non-Jewish father.
Oh, no. So since according to halacha, the way it works is the non-Jewish man will inherit from his father, because halacha recognizes that goyim inherit from goyim. But halacha would not recognize the inheritance to the non-Jew, to the Jewish child, because the Jewish child is not treated as the child of the non-Jew. See, people don't understand this exactly. The rule that if the mother is Jewish, the kid is Jewish, doesn't only mean the kid is Jewish. It also means the kid is not considered to be the child of the non-Jew. On the other hand, since under secular law he is, so it could very well be that we would apply secular law, because as between the rights of non-Jews, we do apply secular law. So in a halachic sense, he would not have any rights, but halacha might allow the secular law.
Even if there was a will?
No, if you're following secular law, you just follow the will.
Right.
Yeah, you just follow the will.
Halachically,
the Jewish son does not inherit from his non-Jewish parents.
With all that,
huh?
With all that.
That's correct. Yeah.
You mentioned that the Bachor has the right to forego his double portion after
yes.
the man died, after
yep.
the father dies.
Yep.
Can he also do that before the father dies?
Well, he could, but it's not effective. Meaning, he could say it, but he could change his mind. If he doesn't want to change his mind, that's fine.
But if he says that,
yeah, but any renunciation before the death of his father is not a binding renunciation, because it's a davar shelo baliyolam. Since he doesn't yet own it, his renunciation is not effective. So it's not forbidden for him to do it, and if he's going to stay with it, that's fine, but he would be able to say right after the death, I changed my mind, I want it. It would not be a binding statement. Okay, we'll see you at 2:00.
What are you doing next month?